This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
There is a widespread agreement among the Somalis that Farmajo did not abuse state power to enrich himself.
Former Somali President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, also known as Farmajo, has returned to Somalia, where he is expected to seek the presidency again in 2026.
Our comrades in the United States with Disarm Genocide, Labor for Palestine National Network, Lifeline for Palestine, and other groups are organizing action in solidarity with Palestine on November 28th and November 29th.
Italian trade unionists appeal to U.S. workers to join them in a general strike against imperialist war and Gaza genocide.
Unfortunately, we've been without a contract a little over a year and a half now, going on 2 years really, and we're calling this an economic strike today.
27,000 members of the American Federation of State and County Municipal Employees, 3299, are on a California statewide strike to demand a contract with the University of California.
United American Indians of New England and our supporters are gathered on this hill to observe a national day of mourning for the indigenous people murdered by settler colonialism and imperialism worldwide.
The National Day of Mourning, also known as Unthanksgiving Day, reminds us of the genocide of millions of Native people and honors their ancestors. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, a.k.a. Farmajo, just returned to Somalia after 3 years in exile in Qatar. He served as Somalia's president from 2017 to 2022 when he was undermined by the U.S. He is now expected to seek the office again in next year's elections. I spoke to Somali-American engineer, writer, and political analyst Jamal Abdullahi about what the consequences might be. Jamal Abdullahi, thanks for joining us on Pacifica Radio.
Good to be with you, Anne.
Okay, Dr. M. Omar Hashi, writing in Burkina, describes Farmajo as, quote, the undisputed president in waiting for the upcoming 2026 presidential election, meaning in Somalia. Do you agree?
No, that would be irrational exuberance.
Why?
Nothing is guaranteed in political campaigns, particularly one in Somalia. Somalia uses archaic method of electing presidents, where a combination of clan elders and regional political bosses select the delegates, then the delegates select the president. No one anticipated Farmajo prevailing in 2017, nor did anyone expect his defeat in 2022, including his ardent supporters like Dr. Hashi. Hence, I think it's a little foolish to declare a victory in a future contest.
Okay, Somalis, I know, all seem to agree that he would have won in a landslide in 2022 if Somalia had managed to establish universal suffrage and hold a one-person, one-vote election. Why is it that Somalia always seems to be struggling to hold this kind of election and never does? Like in 2022, the election infrastructure wasn't in place, and now 3 or 4 years later, it still isn't.
You know, Somalia experienced one of the worst civil wars in Africa after the state collapsed in 1991. And many parts of the country are still in active civil war zones, while other parts are relatively stable, but still experience periodic spikes in widespread violence. Somalia's civil war has been a very brutal one. And in fact, I think this is the root cause of not able to get the country in a democratic roadmap. It is difficult to know how many people have been killed, but estimates are in the hundreds of thousands and millions have been displaced. Enormous amounts of property have been looted and destroyed. There are ongoing violent land grabs and land disputes today as we speak. And there has not been a genuine grassroots reconciliation effort. In fact, peace building and peacekeeping have been largely overlooked in pursuit of clan separatism, toxic power sharing, and a rampant political corruption have dominated the political culture in Somalia. Furthermore, foreign interference by neighboring countries like Ethiopia and Kenya, as well as wealthy Gulf states, exacerbated Somalia's civil war, leading to a prolonged and unrest political instability. So these are some of the most critical obstacles that prevent a legitimate universal suffrage or a one-person, one-vote. The foundation political culture is not just there. It just does not exist in Somalia. So it is little intellectual laziness to say that this is a logistics or an infrastructure. It has nothing to do with logistics or infrastructure to cast or count votes.
Interesting. Okay, you said that a combination of clan elders and regional political bosses select delegates, and the delegates then elect the president. Could you explain the 4.5 clan system?
Absolutely. So the 4.5 political system that gives delegates to four major clans of significant size and status. Then a consortium of minor clans get fewer delegates in a system that treats them less worthy. As I said, this system is very archaic, unlimited in nature, and not very versatile to solve a fundamental political breakdown like that one exists in Somalia. It doesn't have the depth or the dynamicism to resolve major political issues and reconstruct a fragmented and really fractious nation.
What is the origin of the 4.5 system?
The clan-based political system that's currently dominating in the Somali political ecosystem was first envisioned in a meeting of Somali warlords in Ethiopia in the early 1990s. It was then formally established at a conference of intellectuals and clan elders, as well as religious leaders in Arta, Djibouti in 1999. And here you have supposedly the top of the society, or the top of the Somalis, that are actually endorsing a very broken and insufficient system and approach to their political differences. But it was meant to be a stopgap traditional system to end the war so the foundation could be laid for a democratic, electoral democracy at a later time. The original meeting in Ethiopia was brokered by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, which ruled Ethiopia from 1991 to 2018. The TPLF was a longtime client of the US, which used Ethiopia, quote unquote, as an anchor state for controlling the whole Horn of Africa. So I think it is fair to say, by extension, the United States approved and condoned this clan system. It was since then, or it has been, a very divisive formula and a major obstacle to building a more rational, representative, and political system. And it was meant to end the civil war, but it actually fueled. Year after year, there seems to be a fresh set of weapons and ammunition just flooded with civilians.
Wow. Okay, Somalia faces a challenge similar to neighboring Ethiopia's. It can't seem to forge a national identity that supersedes clan identity, in the same way that Ethiopia can't seem to forge a national identity that supersedes ethnic identity. And the challenge in Ethiopia is huge, given that there are more than 50 ethnicities and languages, with the three largest groups constantly competing for dominance. But Somalis share the same language and the same culture. So why is this so difficult for them?
Pretty irony, isn't it? I think the answer goes back to Ethiopia. Yes, Ethiopia is different from Somalia, given it is many ethnic groups and different languages and cultures. But both countries are in a political union that endlessly subdivides itself. The TPLF government that ruled Ethiopia from 1991 to 2018 had a tremendous influence shaping Somalia's current political ecosystem. The Ethiopian constitution, adopted in 1994 and ratified in 1995, for instance, established an ethnic federalism, dividing the country into nine ethno-linguistic states, and three more have been added since then. That system was repackaged in Somalia as a clan federalism. For instance, in 2012, Somalia constitution laid out a process for establishing a federal member states. Currently, each of the so-called federal member states is designed to be politically dominated by one clan or by a subclan, leading to a never-ending political bifurcation, alliances, and realliances. I think in this regard, the latest one is a FMS, or a federal member state, that is based in the city of Las Anod, which has been in an incredible conflict in between 2022 and 2023 between Somali unionists and separatists. This is, in fact, the latest member of this, FMSs. But it's and that what that has done is it it actually united the separatists and semi-autonomous region of Puntland coming together to oppose the newly emerged FMSs. So this model of a federal member states based on a clan and sub-clan system has been a huge obstacle to reconstructing and putting together the former Somali Republic.
Okay, so let me see if I get that. Like Puntland and Somaliland were competing over a stretch of land, and then they came together to oppose the formation of a new state in that stretch of land, the Northeast State, I think it's called.
Yes, yes, the Northeast, absolutely. So it's a very convoluted and confusing state, isn't it? I think the struggle between the Unionists and the Secessionists was very clear-cut. But the once the Secessionists were defeated in the Gochaate, then a new political paradigm emerged, such that now the secessionist and the semi-autonomous region, which was helping tremendously to defeat the secessionists just a few short months ago or less than a year ago, switched sides and now opposed to the emergency or the emerging of this, you know, federal member states. I think it speaks to the heart of the deeply flawed of this governing model, so-called a federal member states, that has been holding back Somalia.
So it's clan bifurcations and realignments that are beneath this.
Absolutely.
Okay. In his previous time in office between 2017 and 2022, Farmaja was known for fighting corruption. It was really impressive, and not being corrupt himself. Isn't this extraordinary in Africa, where imperial powers have empowered one corrupt puppet after another?
Interesting question. There is a widespread agreement among the Somalis that Farmaajo did not abuse state power to enrich himself and buying properties and establishing businesses among his immediate family. In fact, if you talk to many of his fellow clansmen, they would complain about, in order for him to avoid the appearance of clan politics, he has penalize them and remove them far away from the corridors of power. Unlike the current president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamed, who preceded Farmaajo from 2012 to 2017, then returned to power in 2022. This, he has been incredibly corrupt, and everything from mismanaged funds to resale of Somali National Army assets in the open market. So Hassan Sheikh Mohamed has been a disaster for Somalia, and he has been a poster boy of a corrupt leaders, if anything, than Farmaajo was when he was in power.
Farmaajo is also known for attempting to establish a functioning technocratic state with stable institutions. Why is that such a challenge in Somalia?
Farmaajo had the right governing philosophy and the approach for Somalia. His demeanor and conduct reflected on the feelings of majority of Somalis. He was nevertheless a very timid and less resolute in his decision making. He often reversed himself in response to political pressures. There were times where he would make a decision and the public would give a very positive response and welcome it. But the political participants or some of his political nemesis would create a pressure, and he would reverse himself. And that led to a huge public disappointment in various points in his administration from 2017 to 2022.
Yeah, that's what other people have told me, that he wasn't able to stand fast behind his decisions.
But regardless of a leadership style or a personal attributes, the greatest obstacles to building a national institutions are active civil war, fractious political culture, and widespread corruption. And until some of these are arrested or are reduced or eliminated altogether, it would be difficult to put back Somalia as a country politically in the political context, regardless of who's in charge of Filo Somalia, which is the equivalent of the White House.
Farmaajo's most important political project was probably establishing sovereign security forces capable of protecting Somalia's borders and maintaining order within them. That's the first thing that makes a state a state. And many people write Somalia off as a failed state because it lacks sovereign security forces. For decades, a UN peacekeeping operation and a US drone bombing base have failed to defeat the Islamist terrorist group Al-Shabaab, and they don't even seem to have the motivation to do so. Like, donors pay the African peacekeepers higher salaries than they'd make at home, so why would they want the conflict to end? And the U.S. drone bombing operation has been proven to be counterproductive because it kills civilians and livestock, their livestock, which is what they rely on to live, and thereby helps al-Shabaab recruit. But it still goes on with a bigger budget than Somalia's federal government. So in any case, Somalia needs its own sovereign security forces, and Farmajo seemed to be making progress with the help of Eritrea, which was training Somali troops. But I believe that his progress was squandered by Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, the current president, no?
It sounds catch-22, doesn't it? Here you have a Western powers who are extremely involved and part of the political ecosystem in Somalia. They are funding a African troops that's supposed to be a peace mission keeping, and over a decade and a half have not made any significant progress. Yes, some of the early stages had some momentum and some progress, and Al-Shabaab was at least in a optically removed from operating and controlling physical land within the capital in Mogadishu, but has been nothing, accomplished in terms of a defeating, Al-Shabaab since then. These African mission or African troops, mostly from Uganda and Burundi, as well as some of the neighboring countries like Ethiopia and Kenya, have been earning a high salary compared to the Somali national troops. But one of the things that Farmajo focused on as a prime minister and subsequently as a president was ensuring that the members of the Somali security sector, whether it's in the military or the police or the intelligence group, receive their meager salaries regularly. He also pushed a more systematic or a bureaucratic approach, the type that you would see like in a state agency in New York, in the Department of Transportation when he worked there before he returned to Somalia. So that effort boosted a morale among the members of the security sector, as well as the Somali public in general. There was a sense of hope that Somalia may be turning the corner in terms of actually building some sort of a professional army and leave behind the sort of a clan-dominated militia security-based structure. Furthermore, both Turkey and Eritrea tried to help Somalia get past the limitation that Western powers put on its security sector by imposing a UN and other unilateral forces. For instance, back in 2015, there was a big meeting hosted in London that under the auspices or under the umbrella of a new security architecture. And one of the outcomes of that meeting was that it strictly imposed the type of troops that Somalia could recruit, or kind of in a security sector that Somalia could build, including a limitation, the number and the type, that it is. Despite those, Turkey provided a light armor equipment to Somalia, despite the embargo. And Eritrea successfully and clandestinely started training over 5,000 Somali special forces with some support, mostly financial, from Qatar. Those advances were squandered by current President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud in a poorly managed and corruption-riddled effort to drive al-Shabaab out of central Somalia. The effort fizzled, and many of the Somali troops trained in Eritrea were either killed, wounded, captured, or they deserted altogether, leading to an al-Shabaab only growing in strength.
Okay, let me make sure I understand one of the main points here. In the name of fighting terrorism, the Western powers imposed an arms embargo, and the arms embargo made it impossible for Somali security forces to fight terrorism, right?
The arms embargo, which by the way has been lifted since then, was imposed back in the 1990s at the height of the civil war. And this is
Oh, yeah,
back
okay.
in yeah back in when Operation Hope under former President George H.W. Bush deployed a U.S. Delta Forces, which led to another fiasco, captured in the thrill of a Black Hawk Down. So the embargo predates any of the matter, and it's been in Somalia, quite some time, but that has been kept there. And in addition, I think this meeting that I alluded to earlier put a clear restriction on what kind of a security sector and the size of it that Somalia could have. And consequently, it is impossible for Somalia to be able to form a professional army and a professional intelligence to defeat and secure itself against groups like Al-Shabaab and other armed groups.
So then they send in these foreign forces in the U.S. drone bombing operation to do what they've made it impossible for the Somali army to do.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, in the case of the United States, drone operations are pretty inexpensive. They're a dime a dozen. You could have a few, army members sitting at a remote with a desktop in Colorado, for instance, or the West Coast somewhere, and being able to operate a device like that or a UAV, unmanned vehicle. And drop bombs. Unfortunately, oftentimes these bombs harm civilians. And like you alluded in your introduction, they do kill civilians in high numbers. And that in return feeds a hostility in any potential peace operation and fuels recruits for groups like Al-Shabaab and other militia groups.
What role does the genocide in Gaza play in Somali politics?
Well, Somalis are strongly opposed to Israel's genocide in Gaza. The sympathy for the cause of Palestinians, it's deeply embedded in the Somali culture. There are many songs and poems and plays, about it as back as in the 60s and 70s when the whole conflict was, starting and Israel was emerging as a state in the Middle East. So the Somalis are generally opposed to the suffering and the struggle of the Palestinians, and they do oppose, by extension, the kind of a unhindered support that Israel receives from the West, such as the United States.
Okay, and what about the role of the United Arab Emirates?
The United Arab Emirates, or the UAE, role in Somalia has been very corrosive one. The UAE's objective in Somalia is centered around ports as a strategic assets. It wants to control all the ports on Somalia's long and highly geostrategic coast. It has taken control of a number of them already, such as Berbera, Bosaso, and Kismayo, which is deep south, and Berbera is up north, and it's dominated by a secessionist movement. In Bosaso, this is where the United Arab Emirates have been proven to be using as a launching spot in its all of its operation in Sudan. So, in its pursuit of these ports, the UAE has funded armed groups led by warlords in various parts of Somalia. The UAE suffered, though, a major setback in its main training center in Mogadishu when four of its officers, including Colonel Mohammed Al-Mansouri, died in a gunfight. Al-Mansouri was in charge of the UAE destabilization operations in Yemen, Sudan, Libya, and Somalia. So the UAE has been a very bad actor in Somalia politics.
Yeah, they're a population of 1 million and maybe 9 or 10 million severely oppressed migrant workers that's now terrorizing half of East Africa, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very unfortunate for a small country who has made a lot of money or has become very wealthy based on a carbon-based fuel and energy, flexing its economic muscle and buying votes, such as that of Hassan Sheikh Mohammed, to inflict more suffering and harm throughout East Africa as well as in the Middle East.
Okay, the US, particularly in the person of then Ambassador Elizabeth Shackelford, made it clear they didn't want Farmajo in power. She accused him of being hugely corrupt, even though he was most admired by Somalis because he was not. Do you know why?
Yeah, I think the piece that you're referring to that Elizabeth Shackford wrote in January 21 accused Farmajo of not making the federal member state system work, that it is unworkable governing model. I think if she was looking for a poster child of a corrupt political figure in Somalia today, she would look no further than Hassan Sheikh Mohammed. So the problem then, I think, wasn't a corruption in the context of a personal enrichment and buying votes. I think the problem was a governing model expounded by secessionist, clan federalist, and merchants of chaos that just did not work.
So, what do you imagine next year? Do you think Farmajo has a chance of returning to power?
We're quite a ways out of Somalis sitting down and coming together and casting some sort of a vote. I would imagine it would be very similar to the one that drove Farmajo out of power. So I wouldn't count out or count in anyone's chance at this point. I think Farmajo's chance is as good as anybody's.
Okay, Jamal, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
That was Jamal Abdullahi, engineer, writer, and political analyst on former President Farmajo's return to Somalia.
గుడ్డాలో ఫడి సచ్చిరయ్య ఇంతలో గుగుల్ డిక్తా గబ్బాచి లకా దచ్చిరయ్య గూర్కి సిద గీత్ మడ్డరయ్య గయ్యాకి
That was Sounds of Somalia. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. On November 28th, there will be a general strike in Italy to protest imperialist wars and the genocide in Gaza. Trade unionist Francesco Staccioli called on U.S. workers to join the action against the U.S.-supported genocide. In the U.S., Lulu Hamid with Disarm Genocide in Los Angeles talked about upcoming actions at the International Longshore Association and International Longshoremen and Warehouse Workers Union. Frank Sterling played Staccioli's appeal and also interviewed Lulu Hamid on KPFA Pacifica's Full Circle.
Hello, everybody. I am Francesco Staccioli, member of the National Board of the USB Trade Confederation in Italy. Our comrades in the United States with Disarm Genocide, Labor for Palestine National Network, Lifeline for Palestine, and other groups are organizing action in solidarity with Palestine on November 28th and November 29th. At the same time, they will be shutting down Italy again with a new general strike called against the rearm Europe and the war economy, which is cutting down our wages, our rights, and our public services, that is clearly linked with genocide and all the wars. As well done in Italy, they will be protesting the enormous complicity of their own governments in enabling the genocide and the complicity of their principal labor federation, as well as uplifting the call by Palestinian trade unions for an arms embargo. We support our comrades in the United States and all working people around the world. We fight to ensure that our governments spend our taxes on health, housing, and other basic human needs, and not only on murdering people in Palestine or anywhere else in the world. International solidarity is no more an option for working people. We must connect our struggles and strengthen our solidarity network for human rights, peace, and a world that works for all of us. Free Palestine and free the world from the lords of the war.
Again, that was the voice of Francesco Staccioli of the USB Trade Federation of Italy. Now joining us to talk more about what will be happening on that day is Lulu Hamid, Palestinian-American human rights activist and community organizer, and the co-founder of Yalla Indivisible and the Disarm Genocide Coalition based in Southern California. She's going to help bring us some information about this international movement. Thank you for joining us, Lulu.
Thank you for having us.
So let's kick it off with Lulu, since we just heard this call from the International Trade Federation. Remind us what happened a few weeks ago when Italy was basically shut down after the flotilla was attacked, and what's coming up with this international movement led by Italy.
So the Italian workers and unions are heeding the call from Palestinian unions, asking them to shut down the genocide because, as everybody knows, as long as the weapons are flowing, the genocide is not stopping, regardless of any so-called peace agreements or peace talks or ceasefire. So as we all saw, the flotilla, the Samud flotilla, which actually brought so much attention to the genocide that was going on in Gaza, was only mainly able to do that because of the labor movement being behind it and threatening that if they're attacked, then they will shut down the ports. And that's what they done, and they were true to their word. So for the Italian Italian unions, this is part of their fight to stop the genocide, to stop the war economy, So their next step now is to do a stop the general strike in Genoa on the 28th of November. And in solidarity with their strike, there will be actions all over the world. In the US, we're going to have two main actions. The first is going to be in North Bergen in New Jersey at the headquarters of the International Longshoremen Association. And the second one that we'll, Steve is leading and we'll talk more about is the at the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in San Francisco. And then also as part of that effort or campaign, if you will, there are 2 days of action, the 28th of November and the 29th. The 29th is also the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People. So for that, there will also be community actions and gatherings in LA, in Oakland, and there are other events now being planned in New York City and other locations that are coordinated by the Disarm Genocide Coalition, which is a coalition of union organizers and Palestinian community organizers with the focus of pressuring labor leadership to take action, because we know that rank and file have been very actively supporting Palestinian rights and actively trying to shut down the genocide, but their efforts have been censored and blocked by leadership. So the goal for this weekend's action is to call out the leadership, to ask them to respond to their rank and file, to ask them to respond to the communities that they're part of, and their complicity in the genocide.
That was Italian trade union leader Francesco Staccioli appealing to U.S. unions to take labor action against genocide, and Disarm Genocide's Lulu Hamid speaking with KPFA Full Circle host Frank Sterling. That was Bandiera Rosa. On November 17th, 27,000 members of the American Federation of State and County Municipal Employees 3299 began a California statewide strike to demand a contract with the University of California. UC executives and regents have spent millions on union-busting lawyers for nearly 2 years and have illegally raised employees' health care costs. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to a member of SB 3299 and UAW 4811, who were on the picket line at the UCSF Parnassus Hospital and campus.
My name is Yanya Hernandez, and I'm a hospital assistant here at UCSF, and also been a MAT leader for about 4 years.
So what's going on here? I mean, AFSCME has been negotiating for a long time for a contract, and you haven't had a contract. I understand they've taken away increased health care benefits, all kinds of violations of labor law on top of trying to get a contract.
That's correct. Unfortunately, we've been without a contract a little over a year and a half now, going on 2 years, really, and we're calling this an economic strike today, and absolutely, they are not bargaining in good faith. We're not giving us sustainable living wages that anybody, you know, can live off of. We're living paycheck to paycheck. They keep increasing our health care premiums. You know, our co-pays have gone up. Our cost of medications has gone up. And during a time of inflation, you know, and under the administration we're under, working class is definitely under attack.
And some members have to live in their cars. And
yeah,
the question of housing and commuting, yes. having the cost of coming to San Francisco?
That's correct. I've heard many stories in talking to people where people are oftentimes working 2 to 3 jobs just to make ends meet now. A lot of folks are having to commute in 2 hours here, 2 hours to get home. I mean, it's just not sustainable. And I have heard of instances where people are living out of their cars because they just can't afford the rent. People are living paycheck to paycheck.
And it seems like they have a lot of money for billions of dollars for these new buildings here. They're buying hospitals. They bought St. Joseph's, St. Francis, and yet the workers can't survive. What does that say about the regions and the management you see?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they've got all this money to expand. If you can see here at Parnassus, they're also expanding. And there's all these, you know, these new clinics that have popped up, you know, along the peninsula. I mean, it really, that's just very minor compared to what that says about how they treat their employees. They obviously don't respect us. They don't see us as a priority.
And also, you know, my brother was here. He had to wait overnight to get a room in the emergency room. What's going on with staffing? It seems like there's not enough staffing. It's harming, really, the patients that need health care.
That's correct. Unfortunately, an inpatient versus outpatient, even the clinics, like there's short staffing has still been an issue. They're still contracting out and bringing in temp staff. This really negatively impacts the patient care that we provide. It impacts us as employees. It really slows us down. We don't have the resources we need. We're overworked and oftentimes doing the work for two people.
And it's the Regents, governor is on the Board of Regents ex officio. Where are the politicians who really are in charge of UC?
Well, unfortunately, they're nowhere to be found, and we just feel totally abandoned. You know, it's interesting how during the pandemic we were supposedly heroes, but the only treatment we're receiving now is just, it's undignified and it's completely wrong.
And what can people do about it? People want to support UC. It's a great, should be a great hospital, one of the best in the world. People want a great public hospital.
We want to provide quality care, and they should be ashamed of themselves for treating their workers like this. And we support people who, you know, support us and our endeavors to want to fight for living wages. And
everyone should have living wages. And then the fact is, you're working in a hospital and you can't even afford the health care costs. I mean, it's outrageous to be single payer. People should all get health care, and yet you're having to gouge you from your wages for more health care.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. And again, it's a sign of the times that current administration we're under, and just being a working class, you know, union, you know, this labor movement really speaks to the times that we're in right now, where we have to fight just for our own basic needs to be met.
All workers around the world, around the Bay, need to support each other in solidarity. Ask me, these are some of the lowest paid workers in UC, the janitors, the custodians, the food service workers. And as someone in UAW, I think we all need to stand in solidarity with each other. We need to all support each other's efforts. People will ask me, like, a lot of these guys, they commute from, like, Stockton and stuff because they're priced out of the Bay. And they only get paid, like, $25 an hour, you know? So, yeah, I think we all just need to stand together, or else we can't win anything.
What's your name?
I'm James. I'm in the UAW.
Okay. So it's a rich institution. If they have all this money in the bank, why are they not paying the workers?
That's a great question. Yeah, I wonder why. I think they're explaining it well in the chants. I mean, it's just pure greed. They keep hiring more and more administrators, and they're giving these guys $100,000, $500,000, $1 million salaries. They're buying up all the hospitals. It's all just, it's for investments, it's profits for the people on the top, not for the people on the bottom who actually do the work.
You think it's a public institution? It seems like it's run by private entrepreneurs, private billionaires.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. And they care a lot about their investments and not the people who work in the institution.
Those were the voices of striking University of California workers on the picket line of a statewide strike. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. On November 21st, the New York City People's Forum held a discussion with Jimmy Williams of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades and Sarah Nelson of the Airline Flight Attendants Union. They spoke about the attack on immigrants a general strike, and the possibility of a Labour Party.
Those that should not speak out in this environment, it's that risky. Just last week, we had four members of our union, and this is how they've done it. Two in Minneapolis, one in LA, and one in Chicago. An ICE agent goes on a job site, looks around the job site, identifies racially profiles people working, follows them home. And the next morning on the way to work, local law enforcement pulls them over. That is happening in our country. How, as a union leader, can I advise somebody who finds himself in a similar position to speak out, right? I cannot. But I certainly can try to inspire the 80% of our union that doesn't find themselves in that position to speak out and speak out strongly. I've spoken to so many members of ours that probably voted for Donald Trump in this last election and go, I did not vote for this. To Sarah's point earlier, in 2016, when they had to support their member that was being held up, that is a game changer amongst our members. When the person that they work side by side with has been removed, it changes the whole dynamic. In our industry, it's about safety. It's about working together, right? We have people that are hanging off bridges, painting them. And they go, I need that person to my left. I need that person to my right in order to go home at night safely to my family. And they're not here anymore. And that has changed the dynamic. And if I can give any advice, those of us that have a voice in this country, we got to use it now for those that don't. And it's more and more every single day. Yeah, I'll say this on education. Last thing. In our union, you know, what we have done, and I do this every week, similar to the program that you all have went through, we are educating our members around the history of our movement, right? And we are, and I can tell you, we go through the charts, we show them, and we talk about Taft-Hartley, we talk about the PATCO strike, we talk about McCarthyism, we talk about corporate greed and how corporations have consolidated. And a lot of people are hearing it for their first time. You would think that a union member may have already heard these things. Let me tell you something, that's not the case. Most people join a union looking for a job. They don't join a union looking for a movement. And it's our job as union leaders to do that grassroots education amongst our members, to prepare our members for when that moment comes that we're gonna have to go into action like we never have before. They don't talk about Taft-Hartley, they don't talk about McCarthyism. Well, they do, and they call us the communists and the out-of-touch people, right? Our education with our members touching on those roots and then tying it to changing their values and building a values-based organization with our union is truly grassroots power building within our union that I think every union needs to consider how we build that type of connection to our movement, because it ties directly to the rights that are under attack right now and that they need to be aware of.
It's important to encourage that, to foment that, to come to tables to talk about how you organize for that. But we can't set a general strike, like Jimmy said, like we set an arbitrary date for an election. We just can't. What we have to do is we have to be organizing, and we have to, and so it's an important conversation. It's an important idea to put out there. I mean, I'll say it all day long. But it's really about people waking up to what's possible. And if we are organizing around that and we're organizing for that moment, we have to see the moments that come and be ready to move on them right away. So in terms of the, you know, the political party and everything, the reality is that this is a distraction. And I will just use Trump as an example. OK, Trump is totally unencumbered by truth. Right. So he can say whatever he wants. He can promise anybody anything they want. And I went over to the UK and they're like, oh, we love him because he says what he wants. He says what he believes. People want to hear what you really believe. They do not want a polling answer. They want reality. They want to connect with other human beings. We are fed all this idea that we don't want to be together, that we want to just be with our screens. We want to be together. But in terms of the political parties, what we have to recognize is it is the billionaires and it is the working class. And nothing is going to change until we recognize that Elon Musk answers to no one except for when the workers at X and Tesla and SpaceX organize. Then he has to answer to the workers. Jeff Bezos answers to no one. until Amazon workers are organized and make him have to come to the table. That is the political party that we have to build, and that actually will recenter the politics. It used to be that the political parties were more centered on labor. That was because there was a larger voting bloc and people who understood that we're going to mess you up if you mess with us. And so that is the kind of energy that we have to build. And I will just say all day long, as much as I would love to have I would like to have a real working people's party, right? That is nationwide. If we spend our time focused on that, we're just dividing ourselves up more.
That was IUPAT President Jimmy Williams and AFA President Sarah Nelson talking about attacks on immigrants, a general strike, and the possibility of a Labor Party. That was Colonizer by Tanya Tagag. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Since 1970, the United American Indians of New England have held a National Day of Mourning on Coles Hill in Plymouth, Massachusetts. This coincides with Unthanksgiving Day, which was founded on November 20, 1969, when Native Americans occupied the island of Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay. The occupation lasted for 19 months. Keisha James talks about the National Day of Mourning.
United American Indians of New England and our supporters are gathered on this hill to observe a National Day of Mourning for the indigenous people murdered by settler colonialism and imperialism worldwide. National Day of Mourning came into existence in 1970 when my grandfather, an Aquinawampanoag man named Wamsutta Frank James, was invited by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to speak at a banquet celebrating the 350th anniversary of the arrival of the Pilgrims. The organizers of the banquet no doubt imagined that Wamsutta would sing the praises of the American settler colonial project and thank the Pilgrims for bringing civilization to these shores. However, the speech that Wamsutta wrote, which was based on historical fact, Wamsutta not only named atrocities committed by the Pilgrims, Wamsutta's speech contained a powerful message of Native American pride. "Our spirit refuses to die," wrote Wamsutta. "Yesterday we walked the woodland paths and sandy trails. Today we must walk the macadam highways and roads. We are uniting. We stand tall and proud, and before too many moons pass, we'll right the wrongs we have allowed to happen to us." When state officials saw an advance copy of Wamsutta's speech, they refused to allow him to deliver it, saying that the speech was too inflammatory. They told him he could speak only if he were willing to offer false praise of the Pilgrims. The organizers even offered to write a speech for him, one which would better fit with their settler narrative. But Wamsutta refused to have words put into his mouth. His suppressed speech was printed in newspapers across the country, and he and other local Native activists began to plan a protest. The flyer for this protest, which was circulated nationwide, read, "What do we have to be thankful for? The United American Indians of New England have declared Thanksgiving Day to be a national day of mourning for Native Americans." Wamsutta and members of at least 25 tribes, as well as a handful of non-Native allies, gathered here on this hill and observed the first National Day of Mourning. Attendees spoke about the Pilgrim invasion and conditions in Indian country, marched around Plymouth, boarded Mayflower 2, and even buried Plymouth Rock in sand. So, why do so many Native people object to the Thanksgiving myth? According to this myth, the Pilgrims, seeking religious freedom, landed on Plymouth Rock. The Indians welcomed them with open arms and then conveniently faded into the background, and everyone lived happily ever after at the end. Here is the truth. First, The Pilgrims are glorified and mythologized because the circumstances of the first permanent English colony in North America, Jamestown, were too ugly to hold up as an effective national myth. Pilgrims and Indians are a much more marketable story than settler cannibalism. Second, the Pilgrims came here as part of a commercial venture. They didn't need religious freedom. They already had that back in the Netherlands. The Mayflower Compact was merely a group of white men who wanted to ensure they would get a return on their investment. Third, when the Pilgrims arrived, on Outer Cape Cod, by the way, not on the pebble down the hill, one of the first things they did was rob Wampanoag graves at Corn Hill and steal as much of their winter provisions of corn and beans as they were able to carry. Fourth, some Wampanoag ancestors did greet the Pilgrims and save them from starvation. And what did we, the indigenous people of this continent, get in return for this kindness? Genocide, the theft of our land, starvation, and never-ending oppression. Fifth, the first official Thanksgiving did not take place in 1621 when the Pilgrims had a harvest time meal provided largely by the Wampanoag. Instead, the first Thanksgiving was declared in 1637 by Governor Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony to celebrate the massacre of over 700 Pequot men, women, and children on the banks of the Mystic River in Connecticut. Subsequent slaughters of indigenous people would be celebrated by a day of Thanksgiving, and yet we are labeled as savages in the history books. So why does any of this matter? After all, 1620 was a long time ago, and the Pilgrim forefathers had been rotting in their graves for centuries. It is simple. The past influences the present. In her book, Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route, Sadia V. Hartman wrote, quote, I, too, live in the time of slavery, by which I mean I am living in the future created by it. So, too, are we living in the time of the Pilgrims. Because the settler project created by the Pilgrims did not end with the Pilgrims. The evils that the Pilgrims brought to these shores, racism, slavery, the class system, jails, homophobia, transphobia, misogyny, these evils continue to affect the peoples of Turtle Island and beyond. For, as Plymouth loves to remind us, this is America's hometown. The United States was born here, and its myriad crimes therefore rest on the shoulders of the Pilgrim forefathers. And indeed, all settler projects worldwide, past and present, are indebted to the Pilgrims. From the colonial period to the 21st century, this has entailed torture, massacres, family separations, systemic military occupations, and the forced removals of indigenous peoples from their ancestral homelands. Let us not forget that this country was founded on the ideology of white supremacy, the widespread practice of African slavery, and a policy of genocide and land theft. Let us not forget that under the pipelines, skyscrapers, lie the interred bones, sacred objects, and villages of our native ancestors. So the Pilgrims are not ancient history, and we cannot allow their crimes to be sanitized and forgotten. And that is why, year after year, we have gathered on this hill to tear down the Thanksgiving mythology. When people perpetuate the Thanksgiving mythology, they are not only erasing the Pilgrims' legacy of settler colonialism and genocide, but also celebrating it. But Native people did not simply fade into the background, as the Thanksgiving myth said. We have survived and flourished. We have persevered. The very fact that you are here is proof that we did not vanish. Our very presence frees this land from the lies of the history books and the myth makers. We will remember and honor all of our ancestors in the struggle who went before us. We will speak truth to power, as we have been doing since the first National Day of Mourning in 1970. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, in the spirit of Metacom, in the spirit of Geronimo, above all, to all people who fight and struggle for real justice, we are not vanishing. We are not conquered. We are as strong as ever.
That was Keisha James on the National Day of Mourning, also known as On Thanksgiving Day, which honors Indigenous ancestors and Indigenous resilience. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Seltzer, Jacqueline Batiste, Thomas O'Rourke, Paulina Vasilia, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.